Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, when most people talk about firearms regulation, the conversation is usually all about policy. What should be legal? What shouldn't? But today, we're going to cut beneath all that surface noise.
Way beneath it.
We're focusing on this huge sort of quiet crisis that's happening deep inside the administrative state. We're doing a deep dive into California's regulatory system, looking specifically at internal state documents.
Right. Things like budget change proposals, some white papers, and even public records requests.
And what they reveal isn't just a policy challenge. It's a genuine systems engineering crisis.
That's absolutely the right way to frame it. The sources are pretty clear. This is a governance issue, not a policy debate.
Okay. So what's the core conflict here?
Well, the problem is that for decades, they've just kept piling on new laws, new requirements, incrementally.
One on top of the other.
Exactly. And the system underneath it all was just never designed to handle that kind of load. The regulatory framework, you know, what they want to do, has completely outgrown the technology's ability to actually do it reliably.
So if you were to visualize it, it's like trying to run the latest, most complex operating system on a computer from, what, the late 90s?
That's a perfect analogy. The ambition of the law is just. It's totally decoupled from the state's ability to administer it.
Wow.
It's a classic systems engineering problem. The technical debt has become so overwhelming that it's now threatening the stability of the state's own enforcement. It really begs the question, right? How can you have durable law if the tools you need to administer it are constantly breaking?
So our mission today is to unpack these failures, then look at the two wildly different paths forward they're considering.
One is this massive high-risk custom IT rebuild.
And the other is more of a workflow correction.
A fundamental one. And then we'll get into this detailed person-centric licensing framework that's been proposed to manage all this complexity and, you know, the legal exposure.
Okay, and just to give you a sense of the scale here, the sheer scale of this administrative decay.
Oh, this is the key fact. This is the thing that should really stick with you.
The current system is so fragile, so transaction heavy, that the proposed IT replacement, they're calling it the Firearms Information Technology Systems Modernization Project, or FITSM.
Because then, yeah.
It's estimated to cost approximately $450 million.
$500 million. Mm-hmm. And that's just the price tag to replace the existing broken plumbing. It doesn't even add new capabilities.
That is a staggering number, and it tells you so much about how much complexity they've let build up. Okay, let's dive into the core architecture problem that got us here. The white papers call the current setup transaction-centric. What does that actually mean?
It means the system is designed to treat every single firearm sale, every DR's transaction, as if it's the very first time the state has ever encountered that individual.
Wait, really? Every single time?
Every time. It runs a full investigative eligibility check, again and again, even for people the state has already processed, registered, and is, you know, actively monitoring.
So you're saying it's running a full background check on a repeat customer instead of just checking if their status is still good.
That is the definition of redundancy.
Yeah.
It's incredibly inefficient. And this design, this transaction-centric design, it creates massive system instability.
How so?
Well, you get all these duplicated eligibility determinations. You see huge load spikes during predictable purchase surges, like, say, after a major court decision comes down.
Right.
And instead of simplifying how they determine eligibility, the system just scales by accumulating more rules, more exceptions, more workarounds. It's just a spaghetti code nightmare.
And the sources confirm this complexity is. It's off the charts. The Department of Justice, the DOJ, admits they operate 17 different firearms IT systems.
At least 17. Right. We're talking about things like AFS, the Automated Firearms System, which is the registry.
DROS, the transaction system.
APPS, which is the system for tracking people who become prohibited. And CFARS, the California Firearms Application Reporting System. They all have to somehow talk to each other.
And the technical debt, I mean, the DOJ's own documents put some stunning numbers on it.
They do. These systems, built up over decades, have roughly a million lines of legacy code and over 1,200 separate data tables that are supposed to stay in sync.
A million lines of code and 1,200 tables. I mean, to put that in perspective for you, imagine trying to find one specific piece of information, but you have to go ask 17 different clerks in 17 different buildings.
And they all have to check 1,200 filing cabinets just to make sure their records match. It's a great analogy.
So what does that look like in reality?
The DOJ explicitly says the systems are at end of life. They rely heavily on manual intervention, on people finding workarounds just to process the daily transfers.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that even a tiny legislative change, like adjusting the minimum purchasing age by a year, requires a massive amount of resources and slow, extensive testing just to make sure the whole patchwork doesn't fall apart.
And this decay, it creates real public safety risks. We see specific examples where the system just can't keep up.
Exactly. The DOJ noted that the antiquated state of the Armed Prohibited Person System, APBS, literally prevents them from tracking and reporting data that's required by law, like SB 94.
So the administrative failure is directly delaying the collection of critical public safety information.
It is.
So, okay, they want to spend $450 million for a rebuild because they have 17 broken systems, but the immediate cost is... It's just for the planning, right?
That's right. The DOJ is requesting, what, $11.4
million? $11,436,000 for the 2025-26 fiscal year, just to support planning and procurement, just to hire staff and consultants for the FATSM project.
It's the cost of admission to even think about fixing the plumbing. And that staggering upfront cost is why the documents also include this powerful competing vision, one that proposes a lower cost, lower risk solution by correcting the core problem, the workflow failure, without scrapping everything.
Okay, so what does that alternative look like? If not the $450 million custom job, what's the architectural shift they're proposing?
It's about shifting to what they call a person-centric eligibility model.
Yeah.
The whole argument is that you don't need a $500 million IT project if you just use the tools the state already has, but, you know, in a fundamentally smarter way.
We mentioned the system keeps reinvestigating known people. How can they stop doing that without, you know, compromising safety?
The sources point to a system that's already in place and operates continuously. The Certificate of Eligibility, or COE.
The COE, okay.
It's administered through that CIFAR system we mentioned. The COE is already the state's foundation for continuous eligibility monitoring.
So it's not just a one-time background check, it's an active status monitor.
Precisely. If you have an active COE, the system is constantly pulling data from criminal history feeds, court orders, all of it. Mm-hmm. If that person becomes prohibited for any reason, the COE status changes immediately. It acts as the definitive aggregated eligibility broker for the state.
I see it. That's the genius of the shift. Instead of the DR system building the eligibility case from scratch every time.
Every single time for a known person.
The proposal is to refactor DRs to just be a simple authorization system.
Exactly. An active COE status becomes the primary eligibility flag. So when a transfer happens, DROS doesn't launch a full investigation. It just pings the system to verify the person's active eligibility token.
Which is based on the continuous check that's already happening.
Right. This would drastically reduce the investigative load, the processing time, and all the pressure on those 17 old legacy systems.
It sounds like moving from a file checking system to more of a digital passport system.
It is. And to make it work, the plan is to formally designate CIFARs as the single, unified front end for all credentialing. So applications, safety assessments, tier upgrade requests, everything goes through one door.
And part of that involves a standardized firearms eligibility card.
Yeah, the card is critical for making this work smoothly at the retail level. It would show the person's authorized tier level and an expiration date, quick verification.
But the sources say there's a crucial detail there.
A very crucial governance detail. The card would not contain firearm serial numbers or transaction history. It strictly separates personal eligibility from firearm registration. That's a deliberate design choice to manage governance risks and, frankly, privacy concerns.
This is where the proposal really connects those operational fixes to refining policy. It introduces a tiered licensing system. It separates eligibility. Can a person even participate from access? What specific things can they access?
And this approach is designed to organize all that complexity, to align access with demonstrated safety and knowledge. What's important to note here is that almost all of these tiers, except for one very specialized pilot program, are designed to be shall issue.
Meaning if you meet the objective criteria, you get the license.
Correct. No subjectivity.
So let's walk through them. Tier one, the baseline.
Tier one is base eligibility. It requires that basic certificate of eligibility, but crucially, it integrates a knowledge assessment right into the COE process itself.
And what can you access at that level?
Access is limited to manual action long guns and shotguns, and it keeps the existing waiting periods and purchase limits. It's the entry point.
Okay, then the sources show Tier 2, enhanced safety, is where proactive training comes in.
That's right. This is where the state ties more access to demonstrated safety proficiency. Tier 2 requires the COE plus approved training. That could be in-person or an approved online safety course from, say, the NRA or a hunter safety program. Has to be verifiable.
And what's the thinking there? What access does that training unlock?
Well, the training is obviously designed to reduce negligent discharges, improve safe storage, and in return, access expands quite a bit. It includes handguns and compliant semi-automatic rifles.
And there's a really interesting incentive mechanism in there, too.
There is. Tier 2 eligibility comes with a one-time $200 rebate on a qualifying gun safe or secure storage device.
That's clearly meant to encourage secure storage. Subsidize the cost right when a person gets access to more types of firearms.
It connects the credentialing process directly to public safety incentives. Then you get to Tier 3, the collector tier. This one targets people focused on, you know, historical preservation, CNR stuff. It requires the COE plus a federal Curio and Relic FFL 03 license.
And what privileges do they get that would, you know, take some pressure off the state systems?
They get direct shipment of ammunition and regulated components like barrels. And crucially, they're exempt from the one gun a month rationing. The state can grant this because the federal bound book that the FFLA3 holder has to keep acts as the auditable chain of custody. It reduces the amount of low risk data the state's fragile IT has to handle. There's also mention of a Tier 4A, which is a combination of things for some very specific regulated pathways.
The tiered system is a fascinating way to map complexity to risk. But now we have to talk about the highest level of risk management, which is judicial shocks. This whole administrative crisis isn't just about slow computers. It's about creating laws that can actually survive a court challenge when the system underneath is crumbling.
Exactly. The system failure creates massive governance risk. When legislative ambition gets way ahead of administrative capacity, the state risks creating laws that are literally unenforceable, which is just an open invitation for judicial challenges.
And the sources have a concrete example of this.
They cite AB 1263 as a perfect case study. It imposes new compliance obligations that rely on systems that are, well, they're either undefined or just not operational yet.
Oh.
And even worse, it pushes the responsibility for interpreting these vague standards onto private businesses, the gun dealers, without giving them clear rules to follow. That massively raises the risk of a successful court challenge based on impossibility of compliance.
So the solution isn't just fixing the software, it's getting the legislature to admit the DOJ needs a brake pedal.
That is the core statutory governance recommendation. The proposal is to grant the DOJ permanent statutory authority to sequence, condition, or even delay new firearms laws if they're operationally infeasible or would destabilize the whole system.
I mean, the finding in the sources is blunt.
It is. Unenforceable law is itself a public safety risk. Laws have to be designed with real administrative limits in mind.
Okay, this brings us to what might be the most innovative part of this whole proposal, the Tier 4B pilot. The sources call it a mechanism for judicial variance containment. It's basically an administrative pressure valve.
That's the perfect way to describe it. It's designed to manage the administrative chaos that erupts when courts suddenly enjoin or invalidate a major prohibition, like an assault weapon ban or a magazine limit.
How does it work?
The 4B pilot is discretionary. It's subject to extra vetting, including references and a good moral character review, which is similar to the process for getting a concealed carry permit.
So if a judge strikes down a law, what does this pilot do to stop an immediate uncontrolled flood into the market?
It creates a narrow, auditable channel for that judicial relief. It's time limited, 3 years. Access is highly constrained, one duty configured firearm per licensee. And critically, it permits possession of magazines that were lawfully acquired during a period like Freedom Week, but it doesn't open the door for new acquisitions of prohibited items.
So it's about controlling the process of compliance with the court order, not fighting the order itself?
Precisely. The mechanism is court indexed. If a court strikes down specific bans, the authorized configurations get routed to these Tier 4 pathways. This prevents that uncontrolled retail diffusion, the administrative chaos they fear, and instead provides a narrow, controlled, auditable path for implementing judicial decisions. It's the ultimate example of systems thinking applied to legal governance.
So we started by looking at a broken system, and we've ended with two very distinct paths forward. Do they fix the workflow failure with this person-centric governance and tiered licensing, using what they already have?
Or do they go forward with that high-cost, high-risk custom IT rebuild, that estimated $450 million FFIT SM project?
And this choice is happening under some intense scrutiny.
Oh, yeah. The documents show that public records requests have been filed targeting all the communications around the 5th ASM project.
And they're looking for what exactly?
They're seeking to uncover outreach to potential IT vendors,
mm-hmm.
you know, the big names, Accenture, IBM, Salesforce, CGI, and, just as importantly, communications with external lobbying and policy groups. Every town, Brady, Giffords.
That documentation really highlights where the pressure points are. When the state's administrative capacity is publicly acknowledged as broken and hundreds of millions of dollars are on the table.
Of course. Both the tech industry and the political advocacy groups are going to be intensely engaged in defining what that solution looks like.
The source material argues that effective, durable policy requires designing laws with real administrative limits in mind. So given that acknowledged fragility and the documented outreach to vendors who want the contract and policy groups who want certain outcomes, the provocative question for you, the listener, is this. When state systems are breaking down and $500 million Schicks is on the table, how much influence should external stakeholders, both industry and policy organizations, have in defining what is administratively possible, and ultimately, what the administrable limits of durable law should even be?
This is the exact point where politics and systems engineering stop being two separate discussions.